This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. We got another red-hot inflation print for the month of June. That has sparked talks of a possible 100 basis point interest rate hike when the FOMC meets toward the end of July, Tim.
Coming up on the broadcast today, we're going to explore the impact of those rising prices on the luxury goods market. We do that with the CEO of Saks. And then fine dining. We talk about that with Chef Richard Sandoval. Plus, our cover story details a $500 billion calamity in the desert of Saudi Arabia.
Just a mere half a trillion dollars.
That's a lot of money, Carol.
Yeah, it is. All of that to come. First up, one big reason that consumer prices continue to soar, steep energy prices. And while they have come down from recent highs, they're likely to remain elevated for months, if not years. Bloomberg's Will Kennedy writes about it in the economics section of Business Week.
Lynn Duan edited the piece. She is Bloomberg News Managing Editor of Energy and Commodities here in the Americas. We spoke to Lynn on Wednesday, just as President Joe Biden was beginning his trip through the Middle East to meet with the region's leaders, with energy security high on the agenda.
I don't know how you can look at the supply and demand fundamentals of this market and think that we can continue downward in either oil or gasoline prices.
But traders are thinking that right now.
Traders? You know, we just had a story yesterday that I will highlight. It's a bit wonky, but if you read it, it's a scoop about the fact that traders are paying some of the highest premiums for physical barrels of oil in Europe than they have in years. So if you want to ask the traders, who probably know more about this than the economists and the politicians out there, they might tell you that oil is actually still very expensive.
Here's the thing that I think about, Lynn, and I think about supply demand, and I think, okay, first of all, we continue to grow in terms of population. We continue to be a fossil fuel-based economy globally. And yes, there's a lot of talk about alternatives, but we ain't there yet. So to me, that just says, of course, energy prices are going to stay high.
That is correct. We're only halfway through the summer. We have hundreds of millions of people out there on the roads and in the air. We are so close to already passing pre-pandemic demand levels.
Really?
And the International Energy Agency is saying that we're only going to grow more in 2023. Sure, a possible recession. Sure, some inflation could eat into demand growth. But I'm not sure there's anybody projecting that demand is going to fall.
Well, and isn't that too, like you were talking about traders, or we're talking about traders.
Right.
I mean, isn't some of, we were just talking about this with some other members of our Bloomberg team, in that what we've seen in terms of oil prices come down, that's just a trader's thing.
That's
going
what I was
on
saying.
Because,
yeah.
Because it concerns about a recession.
Yes.
But it's not necessarily the fundamental story
that's
when it comes
right.
to
so
the energy
so
market.
That's right. So we're talking about a difference between the macro and market traders
right.
versus the physical oil traders, right? And so, you know, on a macro level, yes, there are recession fears. Yes, there is a fear that, you know, a recession is going to drive the oil market lower because of a drop in demand. But remember that, aside from the pandemic lockdowns in 2020 and the demand that dropped there then, the only economic downturn in modern history that has actually lowered oil demand was in 2008. Hmm. Every other recession has actually just slowed demand growth.
That's really interesting to hear, Lynn. I wonder, though, when it comes to what Mike McGlone of Bloomberg Intelligence tells us all the time, the cure for high prices is high prices. What about the ability of producers to come in and say, hey, we want to take advantage of these high prices, so we're going to flood the market here. Not
right,
so easy.
Right. So the question is, if demand is inelastic and it's going to stay where it is, then where does supply budge? And that's a bigger question. And Will Kennedy actually does a good job of laying out the prospects of oil production growth. I mean, really, the power rests in the hands of Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And they are the only world producers who may be willing and have the capacity to raise it. And that's why you have Biden going right out to Saudi Arabia for a visit, because he realizes that, the world realizes that, and there is a lot of pressure on OPEC Plus right now to be the saviors of the oil world.
I love this line. It's not clear how much more crude Saudi Arabia or the UAE has to give. As you said, Aramco, Saudi Arabia's state oil giant, claims it can pump 12 million barrels a day. It has hit that rate only once. So bring it back home, and we've heard from U.S. domestic producers and the big oil conglomerates that they're like, they've seen the booms and busts. They're not quick running to ramp up production.
And Wall Street doesn't want them to. I mean, honestly, for 2-3 years now, what Wall Street has been drilling into the shale drillers in Texas is that they need to stop spending so much money, stop going after growth, rein it in, and try to make more money out of the production that they have on already.
So something's got to give here, because this is not sustainable for not the world and not for American consumers. What gives?
I mean, I've got to think that if we see a prolonged period of high oil prices in this way, supply gives before demand gives, because that's like a more permanent price signal that some of these industries and world producers can live off of,
right,
and invest in. But also, you know, we touch on the energy transition in
this. I was going to say, do we ramp up the alternatives?
Exactly. I mean, we touch on it. It's, you know, the argument that we make is a really huge surge, an abrupt one like this, can actually be incredibly disruptive for the energy transition, not just because of, you know, high oil prices, raising inflation, thus prompting federal policymakers to raise interest rates,
right,
but also because governments tend to buckle under the pressure of inflation and create a lot of subsidies for
right
fossil fuel industries as opposed to renewable energy. But if you see it for a prolonged amount of time, then you can really incentivize it.
That was Lynn Duan. She's Bloomberg News Managing Editor of Energy and Commodities in the Americas.
Coming up, we hear from an executive at retail giant American Eagle on building a more responsive supply chain.
When the pandemic hit us, it was also a rude awakening that, like, you know, the distribution centers were very fragile.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
We talked a lot about retail this past week, even got an economic data point on retail. It's a sector, as you know, that went through a lot of disruption and innovation during the pandemic, with e-commerce reigning supreme. Well, today, retailers continue to face questions about consumer demand and, of course, those rough supply chains.
One company is rethinking the way it distributes its goods. Shekhar Natarajan is Executive Vice President and Chief Supply Chain Officer at American Eagle Outfitters. He joined us in the studio to help break down the company's collaborative approach.
Even before, like, pandemic hit us, we started envisioning the future of the supply chain, how it's going to look very different. And so if you look at where there was a lot of cost escalation in, you know, doing business, it was really, like, from what I call the middle mile, the time the product enters into the country mm-hmm. to the time it actually gets to the doorstep. And that was the fastest growing expense that we saw. And it's across the board. Like, every industry, every retailer says that the shipping expenses are actually
transportation?
Transportation expenses. They were not leveraged. And so we wanted to change the game. And we started thinking about what would that disruption look like. Because we wanted to disrupt ourselves before the industry disrupts us. Right. So we started laying out a strategy. And that strategy was all about getting the inventory closer to the end consumption point and doing it in an omni-channel fashion so that you could maximize the value of the inventory, reduce the transportation cost, and the miles traveled.
Hold on. How do you get the inventory closer to the place of consumption, especially when this stuff is created half a world away?
Yes. So what we're talking about is once it actually comes into the country, the time basically, like, let's take an example, right? Like, if a pair of American Eagle jeans was actually sold in a store, it would be sold on a Sunday, read on a Monday. The allocations would happen on a Wednesday. Like, you would actually pick pack on a Thursday. It would show up, like, the trucks would leave on the following Monday. It would show up in the customers, in the stores, like, 2 weeks later, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And so the time it takes was about, like, 14 days, the worst-case scenario. And so what we wanted to do is, how do we get to daily replenishment of the stores? And also, like, you know, when you allocate at the store, the product in the store is, like, literally, like, 2.5 days away.
Right.
Right. So that that compression of the time was what we were trying to aim for.
Right.
And so what we did is basically we created a lot of decentralized locations. Instead of shipping from halfway across the country, we started putting distribution centers closer to where people live, started holding the inventory there.
Is it like the Amazon model in terms of regional distribution?
Absolutely like the Amazon model. And when we presented this, people thought I was crazy because it works for, like, you know, diapers and soda, not necessarily for fashion, because fashion changes pretty fast. And so what we had to do was really power our systems with a lot of advanced, like, thinking from AI perspective. And that drove the inventory decisioning and the sciences associated with it, which really helped us, like, transform the business.
So basically, if all of a sudden Tim's really into yoga pants, and they're he lives in New York, you get kind of a spike there, or, you know, in others, right? And the data says, we got to get more yoga pants to New York.
Yes.
It's as simple as that.
It's as simple as that. And, like, you know, creating a responsive supply chain. And when the pandemic hit us, it was also a rude awakening that, like, you know, the distribution centers were very fragile. Like, you know, we have two distribution centers, one in Ottawa and one in Hazleton. And the population was, you know, was affected there. And so we were at the risk of actually, like, shutting down the business, because if those two facilities go down and the stores are not available, then you run the risk of actually not having any of these operations at all.
You don't have the flexibility to move to some, like, one, exactly. Two, that's it.
That's exactly the point.
But even the increased overhead of having more logistics centers, that makes up for it by having them closer to where the demand is.
What we did is actually address that increased overhead. So we went into a sharing model. Instead of us owning the facilities, we started, like, doing that with, like, 50 other brands.
Right.
And that helped us, like, actually make the supply chain much more variabilized.
As you said, you guys are doing more distribution centers, more closer to where people are buying, and that's changing. How much of that has to do with carbon footprint?
Well, it has everything to do with, like, regenerative networks, because I think, like, people talk about sustainability. Sustainability just acknowledges the fact that we have screwed up the world, right? And so we are saying that we want to be carbon neutral. But what we intend to do with this new model that we're building out is to create a regenerative business, which means that giving back to the society. So as an example...
How does it give back, though?
Example. So... when we built out this distribution network that we did, American Eagle grew the business by 30%, right? But we reduced the number of parcels which are actually going to the doorstep by 17%.
Hmm. So less
and
stuff left.
It was less stuff.
Less,
like, because, exactly. Because instead of having stores, like, you know, do all of your shipments, we were consolidating them into fewer locations which could do the shipments. And so the number of packages which are ending up at the doorstep were much, much lesser than what it was, though the volume grew. The second thing, it actually reduced the number of miles, because, like, you're that much closer to the end consumer. So we reduced the number of parcel miles by 2 billion miles.
That's a number. What percentage is that?
Well,
it sounds like a lot, but you know what I mean? Like,
For us itself, it was about, like, 10%.
Okay.
Right? And then, like, let's take, like, you know, the cost of doing business. Because we were sharing our network with other brands through the consolidation
that
we created.
It's a sharing economy.
It's a sharing economy model. Right? So the cost was much lower. So we were able to deliver packages a buck cheaper and a day and a half faster.
Right.
Right? So it's better for the planet. It's better for profits. It's better basically because you're tapping into the local economy, right? So it was better all the way around. And so we thought this is fundamentally a good business model that we should now begin to scale and democratize access for everyone. And that is the mission of this company. And to just to give you some context, I come from, and I'm proud to say that on radio, that I come from slums in India, mm-hmm. where access to funerals, paying for funerals or paying for education, paying for electricity was a big thing. And all we know is how to share. And supply chains is anything but going to be an abundant resource going forward. We don't have enough people. Where do we find all that people? Like, it's going to, the price escalation is here to stay from a supply chain perspective, right? And so the notion of sharing
right.
opens up capacity everywhere in the network.
That was Shaker Natarajan. He's EVP and Chief Supply Chain Officer at American Eagle Outfitters. More later on Retail when we talk to the Saks CEO.
Coming up next, why Wells Fargo is spending millions to help bring diversity to the housing development business.
This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIEFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
As you know, Wells Fargo has been dealing with a series of scandals and regulatory issues for years, and it's operating under a growth cap imposed by the Federal Reserve. Well, last week, we even had Congresswoman Maxine Waters say that the bank should face an investigation by U.S. regulators into allegations that the bank denied black refinancing applicants and hosted mock interviews to fulfill diversity numbers. To be fair, two sides to every coin. We should point out that Wells Fargo, Tim's been working to make some changes, including awarding a $40 million grant to help cultivate diverse housing developers.
We've got with us Gina Merritt, who's principal at Northern Real Estate Urban Ventures. It's a community development organization that's engaged in a holistic approach to real estate development. Gina joins us from Washington, D.C. Gina, how are you?
I'm, thank you. How are you all doing?
We're doing well. Thanks so much for joining us. Talk to us about how you're going to use this $40 million grant. It's called Growing Diverse Housing Developers.
Well, the funds were awarded by Wells Fargo to three regional CDFIs, Community Development Financing Institutions. And they have selected a cohort of 27 diverse developers to provide funding support both for their enterprise as well as their real estate projects.
Well, and talk to us about a little bit about what kind of impact this could do, the money itself, in really changing the system. And I know, Gina, you know, I kind of laid it out because Bloomberg viewers, they know Wells Fargo, and they're not alone in terms of the banking society and banking industry in leaving out, you know, minorities and being more inclusive, especially when it comes to housing. So tell us how you think this money can help move the needle.
Well, this money is certainly going to help my organization. I've been in business for more than 20 years, and have more than 27 years of experience developing affordable housing for other people, never having enough capital to be able to develop my own projects. And so the funds Wells Fargo has provided will allow me to, one, leverage their grants to hire people and to support my balance sheet. And it will also allow these CDFIs to create products that will help diverse developers develop their projects. It's been very challenging going to conventional banks to try to get funds, both early funding, the early stage funding for development projects, as well as construction and permanent financing. So this program helps provide the kind of support developers need in order to get their projects done on their own.
If I can just follow, use the word challenging. It's got to be even harder than challenging, right? Is it fair? Yeah. Okay.
Listen, I was almost put out of business, actually, by one of these large institutions. I was working with a smaller institution that was bought by a larger, you know, brand name financing organization, and that organization would not honor the deal that the smaller organization made to me, right? Smaller financing entity. So the 8,000 pound gorilla basically took over this company and wouldn't honor the deal, almost put me out of business. Wow. So we need organizations like Wells Fargo to fund these CDFIs that will provide financing for people like me, because the major institutions won't do it.
Gina, how do you build affordable housing right now? I mean, construction costs are high, materials costs are high, land is high, interest rates are going up. How do you do it?
It's very difficult. I mean, I have a couple of projects right now in development that are about to close that just experience these kinds of things, both an increase in interest rate and an increase in construction costs. And, you know, I would say luckily, there was an increase in the rental rates, because HUD issues new rents every year for affordable housing developments, and those too went up. So that helped absorb some of the increase in interest rates and construction costs, but not all of it. So then what you have to do is really go back to these municipalities that provide what we call gap funding, which is, you know, all of the private money you can get, all of the low income housing tax credit investment you get, there's usually still a gap, right? There's still some chunk of money that the private institutions can't fund. And so really what we look to now is those states and cities to provide additional support to these projects so that they can get them done.
Is this about also, Gina, creating projects, you know, if we're going to really embrace as a world diversity and inclusion, that means these kind of projects in maybe a traditionally white neighborhood. Is that part of this?
Yes, especially in the District of Columbia, actually. Basically, the financing programs that support affordable housing give you a higher score if you're in a neighborhood that has higher incomes. And so, you know, that just happens to be, you know, neighborhoods that are whiter in terms of its population.
That was Gina Merritt, principal at Northern Real Estate Urban Ventures on the Growing Diverse Housing Developers Grant Program.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Up next, the CEO of a robotics startup tells us about his vision for a human-machine team and why savvy droids don't mean you'll be out of a job.
I'm still a little nervous.
Good news, I think.
I'm not so sure about this one. All right, this is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Fort Robotics closed another round of funding earlier this week, $25 million in a Series B funding led by Tiger Global. That brought the company's total funding raise to over $41 million.
We sat down with Samuel Reeves. He's the company's founder and CEO. Fort Robotics, it's a safety and security platform for autonomous machines. He told us how that money will be deployed and what it's like raising capital in a tough macro environment.
Well, it's certainly a challenge, but we're attached to a big macro trend. We're a part of the fourth industrial revolution, and regardless of what happens in any momentary downturn, this is a generational shift in the way the world works. So there's still a lot of money out there. And if you look at like 2020, 2021, there's still a lot of dry powder. So
there is, but was it noticeably different raising this round in terms of how long it took, the conversations you had to have, the time it took from, you know, talking to these LPs to actually get them to sign on the dotted line? Give us some color there.
I mean, I think automation is unique. So what was noticeably different for us is that the world is now bought into the idea that everything's going autonomous. So we're kind of special in that way. Robotics funding is still going strong. So I think a lot of folks are seeing a turn down, but we actually had a lot of interest in the round and ultimately came on a set of partners we're really happy about.
Well, tell us a little bit more about your business. You guys have been around since 2018, correct?
Yep.
So tell us, because it's not like you're creating the cool Elon Musk humanoid robot. You're
we create a lot of cool stuff.
He hasn't created that yet, though.
But you're controlling the devices, and you're also playing into the security side of this.
Right.
So explain a little bit about what you guys do. Who are some of your big customers?
Sure. Fort is a communications platform for smart machines. So we have this unique fusion between safety and security that enables us to deliver information to these machines that they can trust. And so that lets them address what globally we term as the huge risk of the next generation of automation. So
just come out and say it. They're going to kill us.
They're not going to kill us if they have the Fort platform.
but this is not that you're making the robots, right?
No. We're here to help other people make them. Yeah.
You have the platform that helps people program them, communicate
with
them.
Right. And the fact is, autonomous robotics is still a developing field. I mean, AI has reached a great point of development, but it's still in development. And these mm-hmm. machines are still perceiving the world and acting in the world in a way that is in progress. And so if they're going to be moving around in unstructured environments around people, that poses a huge amount of safety risk. Conversely, if they're connected to the internet, they're all connected to the internet. And so they're all exposed to huge security risks. So whether it's safety risk or security risk, there's a lot of risk on this mega trend. So that's what we're out here to help people address.
Well, tell us a little bit about some of your major customers, right? You play in the OEM market. I mean, I'm thinking warehousing, agriculture, construction, manufacturing, mining, transportation, delivery. I mean, you play into so many aspects of our world. Tell us about some of the customers, what kind of demand you're seeing, and what it tells you maybe about our macroeconomic environment.
Sure. So we have about 300 customers. About 20% of those are really big companies, so Fortune 1000 size customers.
Right.
Oh, so you'll
when you're public, I'll be able to actually pull it up on a Bloomberg function.
Right. So it's interesting. We're integrated into everybody's technology roadmap. So we hold a lot of proprietary information about what all these companies are doing. So they get really touchy about us talking about them. But a few that have been public about using Ford are Toyota Material Handling. They're the biggest forklift manufacturer in the world. Boston Dynamics, you've probably seen there.
We've seen those videos of the dog looking
very YouTube friendly, right? So they did a 60 Minutes where one of our products had a little cameo appearance. Hexagon, big Swedish conglomerate, mm-hmm. they make control systems for pretty much every production environment.
So what does it
Companies
tell
like
you?
That.
So tell me about the demand, you know, that you're seeing from such a cross section of so many different industries that play into our global economy. What's the demand that you're seeing, and what does it tell you about? We're all at this juncture, right, of trying to figure out, okay, recession, what's next? Europe's dealing with problems. Asia's dealing with problems. We are dealing with problems. What does the outlook and the demand, based on what you're seeing, what does it tell you about the economic outlook?
Well, I mean, I think everybody that makes a machine and everybody that uses a machine is thinking about automating it. And this came from the labor shortages that were pre-COVID. I mean, there are a lot of discussions of labor shortages now in the post-COVID world where, you know, like Heathrow Airport today saying they're curtailing flights because they can't have enough workers to move the luggage around, right? But this was a fact of life for people in farms and warehouses and factories, welders, you know, pre-COVID. So the automation journey has been something that has been happening for decades. And so I think macroeconomically, people are still investing in this. They see it as a way to smooth production. They see it as a way to bring back production into their home area.
Talk to us about when you make your trip here today on the train from Philadelphia, and you look around and you see, where are the areas that stick out for you that are just ripe for automation?
So when you drive to the train station, you could be in an autonomous car. When you get on the train, you could be in an autonomous train. When you pass the warehouses on the way to New York, you're passing autonomous warehouses. You're passing autonomous factories. You're passing autonomous farms. When you pass a golf course, turf care is going autonomous. When you're in an office, I bet your cleaning machines here are either autonomous or thinking about becoming autonomous. Retail stores are becoming autonomous. And that's you know, before we get to the really visible things like the cars that have gotten a lot of attention lately.
We hear robotics or we hear autonomous, and we're like, okay, what does that mean for global workforces? How do you see it in terms of what you're doing and how this might play out?
Well, as we talked before the break, labor shortages are nothing new to the economy. COVID accentuated it and made labor shortages really on the front of a lot of people's minds. But farming and manufacturing and warehousing and retail have all been dealing with labor shortages for a really long time. So when we talk about this new generation of automation, where machines are really thinking and acting on their own, what the promise is that you can create a human-machine team, mm-hmm. where together the production is a lot more safe and the corporation that uses this human-machine team is a lot more productive. So we're not talking about replacing tons of workers. We're talking about taking an existing bunch of workers in any given scenario and making them a lot more productive with the human-machine team, which allows them to basically segregate what each party is good at. I mean, the humans are good at interacting with each other and interacting with other people and making critical thinking decisions and things like that. And so we should enable them to do the things that make them human. And then machines are very precise and predictable, and they should do things like that. So,
but it's not only about productive, right, or the right mix. But you also, you know, it was interesting what you said to Tim and I in our break is that, you know, this is a way of kind of leveling out labor costs globally, right?
Right, absolutely. So as the cost of production rises, mm-hmm. in some of the global places where production goes now, and automation over here, automation capability increases, I think we'll be able to increasingly move production back to localized areas in the United States where consumption can be right down the road from the factory and the warehouse that distributes the good. And what that could do is make companies more responsive to local populations, could create jobs in places where there weren't jobs, could make our manufacturing and warehousing work workforce a lot more competitive globally.
Right.
And so I think we've just discovered how brittle supply chains are when they're stretched out globally. And we've just discovered that there are massive labor shortages. And I think automation really addresses both of those.
Samuel, I want to get more into the technology here.
Sure.
And specifically, if you allow companies to operate robots in a safe and efficient way, how do you do that better than other companies? Like, how do you create a system? And I don't want to use the term unhackable because you never want to say that. But how do you create a system that keeps out bad actors and that also allows these things to operate in a way that's safe to the people around them?
Sure. So we've really focused on communications. So we've invented a way to fuse what's called functional safety and cybersecurity to create a way that these machines can communicate in a way that they can trust the information that they're getting. So what they get on the safety side is super highly reliable information, like 10 nines of reliability, so that they can use that information to make decisions about how they move. And on the security side, you know, we start with identity. We use the identity to create authentication and then make sure that they're authorized to talk with only certain parties. We borrow a lot of the techniques that have already been created in the human world. I mean, a lot of these techniques have already been established to make humans secure in their activities on the internet, but they haven't really been applied to machines yet. So we took that paradigm, we applied it to machines, we fused it with safety, and we created this unique fusion of safety and security so that all information that machines process can be trusted.
Big thanks to Samuel Reeves, founder and CEO at First Robotics. That wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Ahead in our next hour, a biotech startup thinks artificial intelligence can predict the next COVID variant.
Bring it on. Plus, the CEO of Saks and why the market for luxury goods remains so strong despite soaring inflation.
And our Business Week cover story, it's all about Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's $500 billion desert disaster.
That's some real money, huh? All right, that's coming up. This is Bloomberg.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including this week's cover story, how the Saudi Crown Prince's vision for a revolutionary new model of urban life is falling far short of his expectations.
Plus, the CEO of Saks on why the luxury goods market remains so resilient, and which demographic has been the driving force.
Tick, 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 tick. Is it you?
So somewhat. I have something to do with it.
First up this hour, some COVID news from this past week, and it's a bit sobering. The Biden administration is now urging more Americans to get their second coronavirus booster shot. This is the Omicron BA5 variant continues to spread across the country.
Wouldn't it be great, though, Carol, if we could actually get ahead of the virus, get ahead of these variants?
Please, please, please. Yeah. Well, someone who just recovered from her second coronavirus infection, I'm talking about me, cases back to back, I would say, yes, let's get ahead of this and the next variant.
Well, this story should give us a little bit of hope. It's in the solutions section of the magazine. Bloomberg News U.S. healthcare reporter Riley Griffin reports on a startup that's using artificial intelligence to help drug makers develop better vaccines and treatments. She and Businessweek editor Joel Weber gave us the details.
The player at hand is A Priori Bio. They're actually backed by a company called Flagship Pioneering, which was the incubator behind Moderna, a name you might hear know. And they've developed this technology that they say can be used to variant-proof vaccines and therapeutics or provide an early warning to governments about the dangerous mutations are to come, just like a hurricane alert. They've spent 2 years in stealth mode building out this technology and trying it against COVID, and they suggest it works. And they aim to partner not just with the pharmaceutical industry, but with public sector partners like the CDC. So we still have to see what products they might bring to bear or what information they've been sharing. But they launched just today with $50 million in funding from Flagship.
Riley, I got to ask. Past 2 years seems like a time that you might not have wanted to be so quiet about this. So, you know, there's the pandemic.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. Like,
hello. People have died. Like, so why the really long quiet period?
Yeah, just to hone the technology. This has been something they've been looking at with each COVID-19 variant. So basically, they take the sequence of the virus and they can plug it in and assess what they describe as synthetic variants. So using the computer, they're trying all these different potential variants out and assessing how they would bind to human antibodies. And as we know, over the last 2 years, viruses are wily things. They mutate ordering to survive, and these mutations can evade the defenses we've either created via natural infection or by vaccine. So it's really important to not just know what viruses and variants could exist, but know how they will behave. And that's how they ultimately will design these variant-proof drugs and vaccines. Why have they been operating in stealth? To really ensure that that technology is up to the task and that they can apply it not just to COVID, but to other viruses like HIV and influenza.
So that's where they're at this point, correct?
That's exactly where they're at this point. They're certainly going to be looking for more funding down the line, but this is, Flagship's a really interesting company, and they're known for doing this. They take, $20, $50 million, they deploy it to a company they've created, and then they watch it flourish. And we've seen that prove successful in the case of Moderna. I think now will be a test for a priori. We're going to have to see where they go, but this is just the beginning.
If this can be used for good to help us predict where viruses are going, could there be biosecurity threats with this type of technology as well?
It's the very same question I had for the co-founder and CEO. I think we all need to be attuned to these questions of biosecurity risks. As we enter this biotech revolution with more information than ever and the ability to essentially come up with a synthetic variant that could be dangerous and damaging, you gotta wonder if that were in the hands of a nefarious actor, what could happen? A priori says that they've been focused on that question from the very beginning, since the time they realized they could make these biologically meaningful predictions, and that they've partnered with external experts to implement, test, and stand up that security. And they cautioned to me again and again, remember, we're not working with viral material. We're not in a lab with the literal virus itself. They are plugging these data points into a computer and assessing and modeling with machine learning.
It feels like we've been playing from behind for, oh, I don't know, 2.5 years now. Is there a chance that this company could maybe help us play from ahead for once?
I think that's the hope. And we got to see what the government does as well, because at the end of the day, a lot of our response comes through public-private partnership. Right now, we're seeing a stalling of interest from Congress in the immediate pandemic response. There's been quite a debacle between the White House and Congress over funding to do this kind of work, really pandemic prep, not immediate deploying of vaccines to people, but thinking through what could come next. And all the demands for billions in funding to do that longer-term pandemic prep really hasn't gotten much momentum. So we're seeing efforts come out of the private sector, but I think we really got to ask ourselves, is the public sector bought into?
That was Bloomberg News U.S. healthcare reporter Riley Griffin, joined there by Businessweek editor Joel Weber.
More variants are coming, huh?
Yeah, I mean, that's like, you know, death, taxes, and variants.
Oh, no. All right. Well, you're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. Coming up, our cover story takes us to the Arabian Peninsula and the planned city, Neom. It's the Saudi crown prince's grand vision for a so-called smart city.
Stick around to find out why it's still far from finished nearly 5 years after breaking ground. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
We turn now to our cover story, the tale of a $500 billion mega project gone wrong. It began when Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman set out to build the city of Neom in an effort to revolutionize urban life.
But 5 years in, the project has been plagued by financial waste and setbacks, much of it because the prince's inner circle just won't tell him no. Bloomberg News Saudi Arabia correspondent Vivian Nierheim and Business Week editor Joel Weber join us now to help us understand this massive desert disaster.
So, Joel, I can just imagine the pitch here. Tell us a little bit about what you wanted to know about this and how it laid out.
Well, I mean, Vivian basically was like, hey, how about we go big on NEOM and try and learn everything we can. And you know, NEOM, if you followed the story at all, has been a huge curiosity ever since MBS first announced it. But then it's been pretty opaque and it's been really hard to get meaningful information about it. So this basically is the most thorough story anyone's ever published about the project. So Vivian, what is the project and how far along is it?
Yeah, well, I mean, what is the project? It's a great question. And I think it's one that I went in thinking we might be able to answer. And then the sort of interesting thing was that even the people inside the project can't often answer that themselves. So it's become this sort of massive, sprawling ambition that keeps going in different directions. And that was kind of what was really interesting to discover it. And essentially, it's a new region now. It began its life as this idea to build a city from scratch. And now it's morphed into an entire semi-autonomous region full of different cities and different towns. And there's a tourism component to it. There's an industrial city that's going to, you know, float on the Red Sea, according to the plans. And there's even a ski resort up in the mountains in what is essentially the middle of the desert.
What is this area of Saudi Arabia like, and who lived there before MBS set out on this ambitious project?
Yes, I've been up to the area that they're calling NEOM now maybe three times over the past few years. It is really remote. I mean, you basically have to, like, from Riyadh, the capital, you take like a two-hour plane ride, and then you also drive for another 2 hours. So it's a place that most Saudis haven't been either. It's right on the border with Jordan, across the Red Sea from Egypt, very close to Israel, which is something a lot of people point out about this project. And it's very beautiful. Like, you know, there's this gorgeous sort of, like, you know, pristine beaches and these really dramatic mountains. But it wasn't super populated. There were, however, several towns along the coast where members of a tribe called the Choithot live and had been there for generations. So it wasn't an empty area, which is what sort of the Crown Prince and other people who promote NEOM have promoted as this sort of blank slate. To invent the blank slate, they essentially began to remove those people who had lived there.
And there were initially a lot of investors, and then there was a killing of a prominent journalist. What happened to NEOM's trajectory after that?
Yeah, well, so Jamal Khashoggi was an American resident. He worked for the Washington Post, which is obviously a major American publication, writing opinion columns. And his murder in 2018 was a huge shock to Saudi Arabia overall, to all of its projects and all of its plans. NEOM took a huge knock. There was this huge advisory board that they had basically just announced that was like all these kind of high-profile figures, all the way from sort of star architects like Norman Foster to, you know, ex-U.S. officials, Ernest Moniz, sort of the former U.S. Energy Secretary, and a lot of those people did actually pull out of the project after the murder came to light, essentially, and there was sort of a lot of pressure to back off of doing business with the Crown Prince, doing business with Saudi Arabia. The really interesting thing that I found as I started looking into this is that a lot of companies and architects and consultants are still doing business with NEOM under the radar. You know, they're still doing plans, they're still doing projects, they're still working with them. And it's essentially almost the largest construction project in the world at this point. Like, it's become quite massive. You know, they have ambitions to have 450,000 laborers on the site within a couple of years, which is basically the population of Miami.
Just the scale of it must be something to behold. And you actually have been out there before, right? So tell us about that. And also, you know, if foreign money's not involved anymore, this is all being done how exactly?
I think that's something they're still trying to figure out themselves. You know, is I think the $500 billion number that they threw out there is like a starting budget. At this point, they still don't even know what a lot of this is going to cost. It could end up costing more. And where is that money going to come from? They still want it to come from outside. But right now, it's pretty much fully backed by the Public Investment Fund, which is Saudi Arabia's sovereign wealth fund. So they're spending, you know, they've already spent several billion on it. You know, they're spending pretty prolifically. I did go up there and sort of do a tour of the site officially. You know, I went to visit their main camp, which is this very sort of strange place in the desert, surrounded by barbed wire, heavily secured, where they've got sort of hundreds and hundreds of you know, high-powered executives and professionals from all over the world who are working on this camp, essentially, which is, like, very much felt like a cross between, like, something from Silicon Valley and, like, maybe, like, a minimum security prison. And even the employees make a lot of jokes about that. They're like, oh, you know, the wall, we're not sure if it's to keep people out or to keep us in. So it's a very strange atmosphere. There's not a ton of visible construction going on now. It's a lot of preparatory work. It's, like, groundwork. You know, they're digging big tunnels. They're smoothing out ground. But it's not like you can go there now and, like, see a city or see, you know, any of the things that they've been planning. There's still a pretty big gap between what they're talking about and what's happening on the ground.
Vivian, it sounds like they start things, they start working on it, and they back off of it. It sounds like a lot of, you know, starts and stops. Who does seem to be winning, though, all in, is if you're a consultant or anybody involved in the project. I love the line you talk about, two buckets for those who work on the project. And one of it is a bucket just to hold all the money that they're making.
Don't mention the other bucket, Carol.
I won't mention the other bucket. Well, you can.
For number twos.
But people are making a ton of money off of this.
There are a lot of people who have found this to be an incredibly lucrative project, and that is predominantly the consultants and the people who come from outside to work there, which was something that sort of came up again and again in my conversations with people, was that this is basically like a life-changing job for a lot of people. Like, they can come and make so much money that they can essentially, you know, it makes a huge difference for their life. They can finish putting their kid through college. They can, you know, save up for a retirement home. And so many of the people who come to do that are basically coming to earn that giant paycheck, and they don't all necessarily actually have an investment in what actually happens once they're gone, which of course is a recipe for disaster. You know, people who don't necessarily have a stake in the success of the project, sort of coming for a couple of years and then leaving. And there is quite a lot of turnover going on. And the atmosphere inside is pretty chaotic. They've brought in, you know, pretty impressive talent from all over the world. You know, you have former executives from companies like GE and Burrow Hapold, you know, working on the project. But there's also a lot of people leaving.
Well, it's an incredible story, Vivian. The cover story of this edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Bloomberg News Saudi Arabia correspondent Vivian Nierheim. Also with us, Business Week editor Joel Weber on this week's cover story. Check it out on newsstands now, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, and of course on the Bloomberg Terminal.
All right, still to come on Bloomberg Business Week: empanadas, tuna ceviche, and slow roasted carnitas. From New York City to Istanbul, Chef Richard Sandoval telling us how he's kept cooking in a world of rising costs and slower supply chains.
This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
La Biblioteca, Toro, Maya. Hear those names and you will think of our next guest, Chef Richard Sandoval. He is founder of the Sandoval Hospitality Group with more than 50 locations spanning four continents, 10 countries, and 10 U.S. states.
His company is facing the dual challenge of rising prices along with decreased foot traffic in the once bustling urban areas where his restaurants are located. The renowned chef went in-depth with us on the long road back to business as usual, a place that appeared unreachable back in March 2020. He joined us from rural Tuscany, and you'll hear it in the cell phone connection.
Obviously, you know, we had to furlough everybody when the pandemic hit. I mean, we closed every restaurant around the world, so it was very impactful. And as you know, luckily, you know, the government helped us with PPP money, so it helped us, you know, stay afloat. And then all of a sudden, I mean, you know, as the pandemic started to go away, I mean, just the numbers of people, you know, wanting to get out into the restaurants and get out of their homes was staggering. So, you know, our numbers just skyrocketed. As you were saying, though, you know, we had our challenges, you know, with labor, with supply chain. So it's been, you know, it's been a balancing act. But, you know, luckily the numbers are there. People are back, you know, going to the restaurants and, you know, the numbers are, you know, are looking very good.
Well, you've got a great view because you've got four different continents, more than 50 restaurants around the world. And I'm wondering what you can tell us about regional differences when it comes to the bounce back that you've seen in recent months, Chef. What are you seeing? Where are you seeing differences and what are those differences?
Right. Well, I think the biggest difference is, you know, I mean, the bigger cities were much more impacted. I mean, for example, New York, has been more challenging. I think, you know, a lot of people left the big cities, and also, you know, people are working from, you know, these new, you know, hybrids of, you know, 2 days, you know, at the office, 3 days at home. So you're not seeing the density in the big cities as far as, you know, lunch business. But for example, I mean, the tourist destinations, for example, the mountains, you know, the resorts, like, for example, the Ritz-Carlton Laguna. I mean, we've never seen this kind of business.
Richard, how much of your business is tourism? How much is business? I mean, I don't know how much of the demographics you guys are able to analyze.
Well, you know, I think it depends on the destination, right?
Yeah.
Like I said, I mean, New York, for example, you know, if you're in Midtown, you know, obviously depends, you know, their lunch business, you know, highly dependent on businessmen. But for example, you know, the Ritz-Carlton, the mountains, you know, it's mostly tourism. You know, Denver, proper, you know, downtown. We haven't seen our lunch business come back as strong as we have our dinner business. So I think every area is different. And for us, you know, we're in so many different places that, you know, we have different challenges in different locations.
How did coming out of the pandemic, how did it, if at all, kind of shape maybe what you wanted to do next?
Well, you know, I mean, I think it helped us, you know, I mean, almost, you know, like recessions, I mean, it helps you make adjustments. You have to, you know, react quicker. You know, we had a big problem with supply chains, which was a big challenge for openings that we had coming along. So a lot of our openings have been delayed. So, you know, I think what we did is, you know, we reacted and started going towards, you know, more local products. For example, Marrakesh, you know, our OSNE, which is all our China, you know, glassware, silverware, was on a boat. You know, it was 3 weeks delayed, so we went actually to local markets and started buying local products. And even in the U.S., I mean, because of inflation, you know, we've had to go more towards, you know, local, you know, seasonal products, you know, to help, you know, keep our costs down, because, you know, you can't, you know, just cost, you know, transport all the costs to your guests. I mean, like I said, you know, we've also had to, you know, work with smaller menus because of the labor issues that are happening in the country. So, you know, we trimmed our menus down. You know, to be able to cut, you know, some of our labor in the back of the house.
Right.
So again, I think right now it's very important to be very reactive to all these things that are going on, because there's just too many things happening and very fast. So you have to be very, you know, very, very reactive.
So, Chef, I'm wondering, you mentioned inflation. Help us understand how much prices have gone up.
It is very challenging. As you know, we've seen the government reporting, I mean, inflation at 9%. So, yeah, I mean, you know, 2 years ago, you know, we're seeing, you know, probably 30% on some products. So, you know, the only way we're able to make up for that is, I mean, I'm sure you're seeing it wherever you're at. I mean, restaurant, you know, menu prices have, you know, gone up significantly over the last 2 years. So I think what we're being able to make also adjustments is by using a lot more local, you know, purveyors, local farmers, you know, a lot of, you know, more seasonal ingredients. And work through that to be able to, you know, at least have some containment.
That's Chef Richard Sandoval, a pioneer in contemporary Latin cuisine and the founder of the Sandoval Hospitality Group.
I'm hungry.
Yeah, so am I.
Let's go. Let's get him to cook first.
Okay.
Do you think he could do that?
I think we'd have to go to one of the restaurants.
All right, I'm in for that. All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up next, beach trips, five-star dining, the end of lockdowns have left luxury buyers in need of new clothes. That's meant some big bucks for Saks.
I'm glad for you to take a vacation because you're going to buy a lot of stuff to wear on that vacation. I'm glad that you're going back to the theater. I'm glad that you're meeting friends and going to weddings. This is all good for Saks and for luxury.
Saks CEO Mark Metrick joins us on the other side. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Coming off Amazon's Prime Day, or was it days this week, Tim? Wasn't it a couple?
It was days. It's an event, Carol.
It's an event.
A shopping event.
Shopping's always an event, right? All right, well, we figured we'd finish up our broadcast with a little bit of shopping and retail therapy. And we're talking about the high end of the market in two very distinct areas, fashion and personal transportation.
First up, Bloomberg Pursuit's auto columnist Hannah Elliott always gets to test out the coolest new rides. And this week, she only needs two wheels to bring us up to speed on a series of electric motorcycles that she says you need to know about.
Electric means even less maintenance on your bike. I mean, you don't have to change the oil. You don't have to worry about gears. You just go. Also, they're a lot quieter. I mean, some people say it's a safety hazard to have a quiet bike, but actually, you're more connected with nature. Mm. There's no sound. You're just out in nature, which is awesome. And then, of course, the efficiency thing. I mean, yes, motorcycles are very efficient already. But, of course, if you didn't have to buy gas at all, even better. It's kind of a win-win.
So is it a combination of the establishment as well as startups that are really out there doing this, Hannah?
Yeah, that's a great observation. We have Harley-Davidson, of course, which is probably the most well-known motorcycle company that is now developing electric motorcycles. They've started this new brand called Livewire, which is a separate brand that's mostly owned by Harley-Davidson, which makes right now an electric motorcycle called the Livewire 1. That's about a $23,000 bike that I've ridden a couple times, and I really like it. It's not going to feel like a hog, you know, with the rumbling type. but it does feel weighty. It does feel very cool. It's fast. It's powerful. It looks kind of like a Harley.
Yeah.
And then you've got other things. BMW is developing electric motorcycles. Of course, they've got electric scooters already on the market. They've teased us with a couple concepts for electric motorcycles. We have yet to see that, but I think it's coming. And Kawasaki, of course, has also announced that they will be developing up to 5 new electric motorcycle models in the coming years.
All right, so let's talk range and charge. What are the stats that we're seeing on some of these?
So, first of all, the charging on electric motorcycles is awesome. Where on electric cars, you might have to wait a couple hours, even up to 8 or 10 hours to charge it. Electric motorcycles can charge to about 80% in 40 minutes on fast chargers, which is awesome. I mean, that's like, you know, you can get a coffee somewhere in 40 minutes. That's about the going rate. And then for range, one that I really like is the motorcycles from a company called Zero, which is a California company. And they can go 120 miles or so in combined riding, city and highway. And that's a pretty good range for an electric bike. Some of the smaller ones, like if we talk about electric Vespas, they might only get around 50 or 60 miles of riding on a charge. But for the actual bikes, you can expect around 100 miles of range. Some of the higher ones like Zero, like I said, will get up to 120 or 130. And, you know, we have some room for improvement.
Are these things as quick as their car counterparts?
Yes. They feel awesome. It's the same as the car. It's instant torque. The minute you twist the accelerator on the right side, the minute you twist, you go. You're instantly off the line. There's no waiting to put anything in gear because there are no gears, which is kind of awesome. It feels very futuristic and fun.
That's Bloomberg Pursuit's auto columnist, Hannah Elliott. just the tip of the iceberg on these new e-bikes. Check out her full piece online at Bloomberg.com or on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Go online because the pictures are pretty amazing. I know this is radio, awesome. You're listening to our podcast, but man, it is.
You got to see these bikes.
They're like futuristic.
And like she said, they are quick.
They are. All right. Right now, we're going to turn though our attention from EV motorcycles to luxury fashion. Mark Metrick is the CEO of Saks. It's the digital spinoff of the popular department store and upscale chain. We're talking about Saks Fifth Avenue. The company's new luxury pulse survey has some surprising findings on its resilience in the face of inflation, as well as the demographics driving the business. I'm just going to put it out there. Tim and his wife, I think they're shopping.
Yeah, but I mean, that Saks is expensive.
All right, here's what he had to say.
We feel very good about the core luxury consumer, just both from how they're showing up and how they're shopping. And also they've indicated, 75% of respondents to the survey that I would categorize in that core luxury consumer said that they would spend the same, if not more, over the next 3 months than the prior 3 months.
You're talking about people, just so we can have these definitions for our audience, these are people who have an income of $200,000 per year plus?
Yes.
Okay. So like a household income or an individual?
A household.
Okay.
And are they younger, older? What are they? I love knowing the demos when it comes to retail.
Well, it's about stage, not age. These are people that are luxury consumers. They love fashion. They're aspirational. They're core. They're a bit all over. But if you really want to dig down and look at it, you're actually seeing a little bit on the response side, more positivity. And it's probably from a recency bias because the younger consumer hasn't seen one of these moments before. They're feeling a little bit more bullish than the boomers or the silent. So interesting. But again, the overall response has been positive on what they're thinking from a luxury standpoint.
So from a luxury standpoint, are they buying luxury clothes, luxury stuff for the house, luxury, cosmetics? Like what specifically? Luxury can cover a lot.
Yeah. So for us, it's about accessories and apparel. Okay. That's where we center. Now they're still looking at home and other types of luxury products inside of their lifestyle. But the core business for us is around that apparel and accessories and leather goods.
What kind of luxury apparel? Like, have people moved away from all of the comfy wear? And listen, I love a great pair of yoga pants. They're not inexpensive. So I consider that kind of luxury as well. But are people trading up? They're going out, they're going to places. And so you can see that reflected in what they're buying.
Absolutely. And we're seeing and a great indicator of that is sneakers became, it's like you almost only wore sneakers for a while. And now we're seeing shoes make a big comeback. And that's been good. Guys are getting dressed up again. She's getting dressed up. It's a dressy sandal. It's not just a sandal. It's a shoe. It's not a sneaker. There's a lot of heel coming back. Platform heels are going to be one of our biggest trends as we come into the next couple months. So it is about getting dressed. It is about going out. It's about traveling, and it's good for business.
Can I just say, I love me some platforms, Tim. I'm just going to put that out there.
There you
okay,
go.
I got nothing to follow up on that, Carol. I do want to know, Mark, though. I want to know about how spending has shifted, because if I think about what we've been talking about for the past 2+ years, the idea that people filled their homes with stuff, and then it got stuck on ships, so they couldn't do that. Then they started buying things as they got back to the office. But now it seems like demand for vacations and experiences is back. This idea of stuff we were talking about back in 2019, especially when it comes to millennials spending their money on not on stuff, but on doing things. How did that factor into your research?
Yeah, so the research came back and look, when asked, respondents number one on their list is travel and leisure. That's fine because with luxury and again, being a GOAT, so being that go out and travel, I'm glad for you to take a vacation. Because you're going to buy a lot of stuff to wear on that vacation. I'm glad that you're going back to the theater. I'm glad that you're meeting friends and going to weddings. This is all good for Saks and for luxury. So that's okay. But right on the heels of that response, again, was leather goods and accessories. We're right there behind that for this, high-end luxury consumer on where they and how they want to be spending.
Mark, help me out here because, when we talk retail and the consumer world, we constantly talk about, and we often have heads of companies talk to us about this seamless omnichannel experience. So you guys are focusing on e-commerce. How do you guys do it? How do you make sure that you're covering how the consumer wants to shop?
Yeah, you know, and we do focus on e-commerce, but we focus on the consumer. And that's really, you know, what we've done with this split is just enabled my company to focus on the digital experience, but it's focusing on the brand experience, you know, first and foremost. We haven't stopped with the omni-channel connected experience for our consumer. Our exclusive partnership with the SFA stores enables us to execute this all-channel experience seamlessly. You can, you know, 40% of the returns that came in from Saks.com went into the stores just this past quarter. So you can buy online, it can ship from a store. So what we've done is really just given ourselves the ability to build two strategies, but those two strategies connect through the consumer.
Give us an update on the supply chain and give us an idea of if you're able to stock shelves, if you're able to actually get consumers what they want.
Yeah, the luxury supply chain, you know, probably on a relative basis hasn't been interrupted. I'm sure it's a little bit slower than people want it to be, but comparatively to what we'll be hearing, we haven't had any issue with that.
What's the last thing you bought in a retail environment?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
I just bought a suit. How's that?
Okay.
All right, back to work you go.
That sounds, yeah.
Absolutely.
That isn't like athleisure or workout.
Wait, is that for hanging out or for working?
To be fair, it's a suit, but it's got drawstring pants.
How about that? A suit with drawstring pants. I mean, that sounds pretty nice. Like luxury, but casual. I mean, I could wear that to the office.
I thought he was saying comfy clothes were kind of going away. No?
Oh, this is like a mix of formal and comfy.
I mean,
business on top party. I don't know.
All I know is put stretch in everything. I'm down with that.
A huge thanks to Mark Metrick. He's CEO at Saks.
And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find that at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal. Have a good and safe weekend, everyone. This is Bloomberg.